Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I'm very pleased to be rejoined by a favorite guest of the show, frequent visitor here. And I would like to think that the reason you guys over at The Ankler, which, you know, you're growing by leaps and bounds, you're getting nice write-ups in Vanity Fair and the such, Richard, is because you were the first guest on The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. That's what really has sent you shooting to the moon here.
I can't think of what else has propelled it. And this is completing my trilogy, meant to be listened to as a set also of appearances. So all the little seeds I planted in my first appearance are going to bear fruit and explode in this episode. So,
well, the Ankler cinematic universe is a key portion of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood, as people know. You know, we've had you on the show, we've had Sean McNulty on the show, we've had Janice Min on the show. It's one of these days we're going to get the entertainment strategy guy out of his hole.
He claims he's working on a voice disguiser.
He's been saying that for months now. He's been saying that for a year now. I'll believe it when I see it. Maybe I can troll them into getting it together. But it's very nice to have you back on the show, Richard Rushfeld of The Ankler. Very excited to have you on. And we're talking about a very serious topic today, because I have for months now have been banging the drum on this, been at least in part on Richard's insistence. But frankly, I think it's the underreported story until now. People are finally starting to pay attention to it. And that is the very real possibility of a strike by the Writers Guild of America. It's been, 14 years since the last strike, 15 years since the last strike. We're about due for one. But also, it's not just a matter of being due for one. The issues at play are somewhat intractable. Am I right or am I wrong?
They require... Either way, so there's two ways that that the issues can be addressed. That the streamers in particular can completely reorganize the way they do their business, or they can completely reorganize their economics so that the way they produce a million shows completely changes. So it's the question of, in the next 6 weeks, is the streaming world going to completely reorganize itself? And on the other side of it, you have the writers who are, I think, absolutely show every sign of they're absolutely willing to take this all the way to strike and beyond if it comes to that. So,
well, I mean, this is so I am notoriously kind of labor unfriendly, at least amongst my friends. My friends, you know I'm a man of the businessman, not the little man. But this is one of these cases where I am almost completely on the side of the writers, because it seems to me that the situation is entirely untenable. That there were economic promises that were made that are, frankly, very hard to keep. And most importantly, really, the issue here that is most unsolvable from my point of view, and you touched on this a little bit in your big piece at The Ankler, which is why I'm having you on the show. I should have introduced this properly. Richard wrote a good kind of stage setting piece for the 70 days we have until the contract between the Writers Guild and the producers expires. But the real issue here, and I don't know how anybody is going to solve this, because I think the streamers would rather die than do it, and the writers can't survive without it. But it's about data. It's the only way to ensure that the writers are properly paid for how successful their products are is for them to get access to much better data than we have. And the streamers have absolutely no interest in giving that up, right?
I mean, that's the thing with the tech companies. Data is I mean, data is everything. That is what you're in for. It's like asking, you know, it's like asking them to give their firstborn children over. Like that's not. I think here in Hollywood, we think of data as just some little number thing that's on the side, but that is the reason you do it in the tech world. And the idea of giving up their data is beyond anathema to them. But the flip side is, if they don't want to give it up, they can just pay vastly more for the service. They could just pay everybody like every show is a hit. So that would work too. It makes it then untenable to produce, release 50 new shows every week. But at that cost. But it's because part of this also is the writers are just the edge of the spear here, and they're going to be followed by the directors and IA and everyone. So if the writers get concessions, then everyone else is going to come along and get concessions. So if they fundamentally change the economics of this, then it's going to go all the way down the line there.
Well, right. I mean, let's take one step back to what you mentioned here, which is that, you know, the writers aren't, strictly speaking, dealing with movie studios in the classic sense, right? It used to be you're the writers or the actors or the directors, they band together and they're negotiating against Paramount and, Universal and Disney and whoever else. Really, though, they're in the midst of dealing with tech titans. They're in the midst of dealing with companies that were founded on kind of Silicon Valley ideals and ideas. In some cases, companies that only are very marginally involved in the film business, companies like Amazon and Apple. In other cases, companies that are entirely involved in the film business like Netflix. But they all have that kind of tech mindset in which writers are to be looked at essentially as synonymous with factory employees in an Amazon factory, right?
Yeah, exactly. And they think the value that is created comes from a very few people at the top, the cult of the founders, and all of them would have engineering degrees. Like anyone who doesn't have engineering degrees is like barely a human being in their mind, I think. And the idea is you squeeze everybody else for however the cheapest you can get labor for in every possible way. And then we've seen that across the board. The problem is that Hollywood really is kind of the most democratic of industries in a lot of ways, because for all its flaws, it has supplied a good living way, even as people at the very top have gotten enormously, fantastically wealthy. It's had a very good living wage for everyone from the stagehands to the makeup artists to the writers all the way down the line for 100 years now, until the last 10 years, and that's what's being threatened.
Well, so let's zoom in a little bit specifically on the writer. So, I mean, here's the argument that the studios would make, right? The studios would make the argument that we are employing more writers than ever before. More writers than ever before are getting jobs on our shows, because we're making 5,000 shows a year. And, each of those shows needs, six people at least in if we're doing a mini room, or it needs, 10 people if we're doing a full room. So how are we supposed to be able to afford? And on top of this, we're losing money. All the streaming companies are losing money. How are we supposed to make money if we pay you more, who we're also employing more? We're going to have to fire a bunch of people. But how do the writers respond to that?
I mean, the streamers are basically saying, in Bling Robbery, we created a situation where we have to do a insane number of shows that are unaffordable. So you have to support us doing this insane number of shows that are insupportable. This is an unsustainable situation that they created. So, you know, they can't suddenly come in and say, you know what, we're too many shows, we can't have fire alarms in the offices anymore. So if some of you have to burn to death now and then, you know, that's the cost of putting out 100 new shows a week. It's their responsibility, and working in Hollywood requires a vast skilled labor force. And if people can't afford to live a normal life, middle class life as a writer, and it goes to and becomes, you know, interns and 21-year-olds writing your shows, well, you're going to see what you get from that, and it's going to be not too far from TikTok videos of someone skateboarding into a wall, I think.
Well, you, as you note in the at the end of your missive the other day, you know, there's nothing less at stake here than the fate of civilization in a very real way.
I think so. It you know, but for the nail, the kingdom was lost. It's if this is the Writers Guild negotiation is what it comes down to, is can Hollywood, which has created a very high standard of professionalized entertainment and culture, the greatest culture factory the world has ever seen, can it survive doing that? And if the Writers Guild negotiation fails and it's followed by the other guilds collapsing in the same way, the road to TikTok is wide open, and the idea of a high standard of professionalized culture collapses. And I don't, thinking about a civilization where, you know, you don't have 2.5 men, let alone forget about, you know, Tar. It's like that, where you just don't, this is how people learn how to understand the world and how to relate to others through cultural products, whether it's a sitcom episode or, you know, it's rarely a little independent film that of the type gets nominated for Oscars, but it's still a very high standard of entertainment product. And if that disappears, we forget how to talk to each other and relate to each other in a big way. And civilization, I think, gets much worse. So all that is on the backs of the writers right now, that if they can't produce a victory out of this, then civilization collapses.
You mentioned, and this is a thing I do hear from my friends who are working writers sometimes, in particular, is that, look, you know, we've got a bunch of people in the guild who aren't working right now, who kind of see this as a chance for a big adventure. You know, they're going to stick it to the man. They're going to get out there and they're going to take all of us out of work. We're all going to be out of work. And that's not great. Nobody wants that. Do you think there is a split in the membership between folks who are itching to strike just to do something and the others, or is that less of a concern than it might otherwise be?
I mean, and that's always a very real factor with the Writers Guild, and it's why, you know, anytime they put something to a vote, in the last election, the most militant faction won overwhelmingly. I mean, not with like 60%, but with like 85% of the vote. Like, they, you know, huge margins, because there are a lot of people in the guild who are unemployed or underemployed, and just, you know, just young folk who don't know what a strike really boils down to, or happy to it, are happy to just spend a few months waving their fists outside the studio gates. But this time, you know, in the past negotiations, I've felt that faction was driving the writers off a cliff for things that aren't really meaningful. This time, like you say, I feel like these are truly important issues, and the lunatics are actually on the side of the right, and things that have to be addressed this time.
How do you compare the mood right now to the mood in 2007, 2008, which is the last time we saw a big strike? I mean, I know folks really were convinced that there was going to be a strike in 2020, and that kind of fizzled out, I think, in part because of COVID. But there was some, you know, there's other stuff going on then, too. But this does feel like the first time, really, that, like, looks like it's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, when was it? Four years ago. Everyone was betting it was going to happen. They came to agreement at the last minute, and my strikeometer still gives that a 1 in 3 chance of happening this time. So I'm not saying that's impossible, but I'd say the feeling is much worse than it was in 2007. I think in 2007 they had a real grievance and a lot of anger and a lot of people charged up and ready to take to the streets to do something about it. I think this time there's a sense that this profession might collapse and that we can't go on, and that everyone who's in it knows lots of people who had to give it up and leave the profession, leave Los Angeles, which is at the time all this is happening, become a fantastically expensive place to live. I don't think the last time it was seen as a fight for the survival of the profession, but I think it really is seen like that this time, and there's much more fear.
What does the profession of a screenwriter look like if they aren't able to extract real concessions from the producers here? I mean, are we just looking at a situation in which you have 1,000 people who are working 3 different shows a year and trying to scrape together, $100,000 to live in Los Angeles? What does it actually look like to be an employed writer in the future that Netflix and its ilk want?
I think it's really hard. A big part of it is when I was a freelance journalist, I would say, like, if you got a contract, it was worth almost double the money that the contract paid, because you had predictability and you could plan your life around it and you knew what you did. And if you're just constantly hustling for the next job, constantly looking for the next thing, it just makes life so much more chaotic and scary, and you can't work in a normal way. It's a force. What's the opposite of a force multiplier, a force divider, or whatever in your life? And so it's, people hustling for these 6-week jobs that may get even smaller. A big part of the thing is these mini rooms now that they've allowed the streamers to create, where it's just a tiny number of writers or just one writer doing it. So it's less people employed for less time, and it just becomes really difficult to scrape all that together for a living. So it'll become the people who have family money, the people who have a spouse who is actually supporting them. Basically, people are doing it as a hobby. Mm-hmm. And Shonda Rhimes and Ryan Murphy will continue to work and be able to pay their rent. And then a lot of 21-year-olds who will do it for a couple of years and then go to law school.
So it'll become like journalism, is what you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we blazed the trail to set the template for ruin of an industry here.
Oh, maybe. Good. Glad we could do that too. I guess here's a point that you bring up in your newsletter that I think is kind of interesting and underexamined, which is that the studios aren't really the studios anymore. The studios are not really playing the same game anymore. You have Netflix, which is doing its own thing. You have Warner Brothers Discovery, which is doing its own thing. You have Apple and Amazon, which are essentially the dilettantes waltzing in and, just trying to win awards or like doing this little boutique thing that's for prestige. Is there any way, why wouldn't the Writers Guild start trying to negotiate with everybody separately instead of the Producers Guild as a concept? Because I think that I understand why you don't want to do that, but I also don't understand why the Writers Guild feels compelled to deal with all of these companies at once instead of taking them part by part.
Yeah, I've thought of that too, and I bet that is an outcome. I think at the moment the producers are still hanging together and refusing to have separate talks, but at some point you have to wonder if you're David Zaslav or Bob Iger, or Are you going to go down because Ted Sarandos doesn't want to change the way he does business? That Iger and Zaslav could easily probably work this out and come to terms and all that. But for the streamers, it's very difficult. And it's difficult, as you say, Apple, which is now, if you look in the number of shows they're producing, huge. I mean, it's a little boutique thing, but it's huge now. It's huge amount of production. Nobody even knows why they're in it. Like, what is the point of this? So it's very hard to align your goals if you're producers with a company that you don't even know what the heck they're doing here. Amazon, everybody assumes they understand that it's to get people to buy more diapers on Prime, but no one actually knows that. And how that economics all adds up. The problem is that if the scenario someone's suggesting to me, if say the legacy producers start talking on their own, that the streamers could undercut them. Here's a scenario for you. And say, okay, we're going to make a great deal with the Writers Guild, and we're going to go off on our separate. We're going to make a fantastic deal that you legacy studios can't even begin to afford to match, and then we will just drive you all out of business in 2 weeks. So there is some incentive for them to hang together for this, because they could do a lot to stab each other in the back.
Yeah, I mean, I just, you know, I look at this situation and it seems to me the best play for the writers is to play hardball and then to try and pick somebody off. Because I like, again, Netflix's whole model is based on, Netflix's whole business model is based on, we have all the data, we know what people want to watch, we know when they're turning off, we know blah, blah. And if they are loath to give that up to ensure some sort of proper residual payout, because that's really the big deal. That's the issue here is as much as anything else, as much as the small writers rooms, as much as the uncertainty, the idea that Netflix has these huge shows that do hundreds of millions of hours of views, and then the writers don't see any of that after the fact is maddening to them. It's not how the industry works, or at least it's not how it has worked until now.
I mean, it's so bad for the industry in so many ways. It's bad in terms of how people get paid and how they get their money. But it's also, I mean, this is the worst effect of the streaming world, that we created this system whereby the creators of shows and people who work on them are going to get no feedback and no audience metrics, no response, no nothing. Like you get, everyone tells a story of you debut a show on Apple or on Netflix, and it comes out, and on Monday you get a call from a VP maybe who says, yeah, we feel good about it. Did all right? or maybe you don't get a call. And then you try to figure out what that means. And it's that's the metrics now. And it's just, you know, since ancient Greek theater, it's the audience response. It's there's a feedback loop here that to just cut that off has been a terrible thing artistically, and it's a terrible, and it makes it really hard to for people to make deals and make money and to understand what their work is worth also.
Yeah, David Mamet has a riff on this in one of his books, maybe his book on theater. But basically, the idea that artists and playwrights getting money from government subsidized organizations is bad, because what it does is it reduces the need to please the audience with good theatrical, you know, stage productions. And once you start doing that, you end up just going into your own little headspace where you're not actually producing anything worthwhile, which I think it's a real risk for a lot of these streamers in particular.
Not saying everything has to be Avatar, but within your own world and your own sector, to have some idea, like, is this resonating with the people that I was trying to speak to at all? Like, and instead you just know, like, is some Netflix VP saying he's happy today? That's which may or may not be related to how your show did.
That's all we can hope for, is to make Faceless VP number six at Netflix happy. Here's a question for you from your side of things, from the reporting side of things. How have things in the reporting of Hollywood business changed over the last 15 years? Because one of the interesting subplots of the 2007-2008 strike was that it is in part what allowed the rise of Nikki Fink and Deadline Hollywood Daily, right? It shifted a sea change in the way the industry news broke from Variety and Hollywood Reporter to kind of more, newsletters, blogs, that sort of thing. And now that energy seems to be shifting almost entirely to the world of newsletters. I mean, obviously, Variety and Hollywood Reporter still doing good, interesting work. But when I want to read about what is really happening in the strikes, I read The Ankler, right? I read David Poland's newsletter. I read what other writers are looking at. Where are the writers going to go to this time around to make their case most directly to the public?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of plans here at The Ankler to try to amplify those feelings, but I think it is from newsletters, from podcasts. I don't think they're going to find the big Penske Media institutional voice. Penske Media is the media company that owns all the trades, essentially, except for us little upstarts, being there on the front lines for them. The trades are too much. The downstream effect of what Nikki did of sort of breaking news faster and not waiting for the stately pace of the morning paper was that everyone is the trade reporting is really driven by all these little scoops of, like, you know, Two and a Half Men announces its mid-season return date, and who gets to announce that, or someone switches agents, or a script deal happens, and all these little things that are just too small and boring that no one, not many people even inside Hollywood care, let alone people outside. But that is 90% of what trade reporting is. And to get those little scoops, you have to be, you know, very cozy with a lot of people, and you have to with the companies and everything. And they are very vocal when you annoy them, and they're not going to send things your way. And then, you know, the trades also have all sorts of, they need people for their covers now. They need people. They do the cover stories. They do all these conferences. They need people for the conferences. They need people for their, they have their, you know, for your consideration contenders videos and all this. And they need stars for those things. So they're enmeshed with the people that are covering in so many different ways that it's kind of just unthinkable. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, even before Nikki Fink, it was when I was at the LA Times, the columnists there were thought of as incredibly soft and that they were easy on the industry. They routinely called for heads of studios to be fired in ways you can't imagine any trade person doing that. I mean, you look at them, you look at them today, and you would think, like, those people were savages. But it just, like, it's unthinkable that a trade people write that way today.
Yeah. In your letter, you put the odds of a strike. The strike meter is at 65% right now. I guess if we're talking about doomsday clock, we're still about 4 minutes away from midnight. You know, we've got a little ways to go. But I do think this is the most worried you have been in some time.
Yeah, since I started doing The Ankler, I think the highest the strike-o-meter has ever gotten has been to about 20-25%. The previous showdowns, I really didn't think that they were going to come to strikes, that the issues didn't seem clear or serious enough for that, and ultimately they were resolved in the nick of time. Remember, they can also choose at the last minute. They can say, okay, we're going to extend the contract for another 3 weeks so the talks can continue. So the May 1st deadline may not be the actual deadline. But I think that there's still a chance that when, I mean, it's in the studio's hands right now to come up with something that seriously addresses these issues. And I still think there's a better than an okay chance that when they look into the abyss of what a strike means, and you know, none of these companies, including Netflix, has had such an easy stock ride in the last couple of years. And what happens to Netflix stock if the industry goes on strike now, and they're looking at being depressed? So when they stare into that, they may suddenly find they're a lot more flexible than they thought they were.
Yeah. As you know, I always like to ask if there's anything I should have asked, if you think there's anything folks should know about state of the industry, state of the Hollywood media. What should folks have on their radar?
You know, and I never prepare for that question. You'd think after all these interviews, all these visits, I'd have something prepared for that. the hits are we're very focused on sort of the big corporations and the big productions and everything, and the hits are going to come from unexpected places. And what changes Hollywood is going to come from probably new companies doing things differently, new kinds of films you weren't expecting. Like this weekend we have Cocaine Bear and Jesus Revolution, which are both in different ways as far from Marvel films as you can get. But I think the entrenched, you know, Netflix made a big shakeup of things, but seems incapable of going beyond its initial tenets. So I think it's time for another change and something else to come along that's going to shake things up. Hopefully it won't be TikTok outlawed, which I enjoy watching the videos there very much, but hopefully that isn't the entire future of entertainment. There's a lot of room for something else.
Fingers crossed. All right. Thank you once again for being on the show, Richard. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
There was a very nice profile of you guys in Vanity Fair. I'll include a link to that. Folks can read that if they so choose, and they should go subscribe at The Ankler.
Absolutely, and I'd say also that much of what I wrote was informed by Sean Ryan's conversation with you a couple weeks ago. That he laid out the issues I think better than anyone else has anywhere else. So people are interested in the subject, I recommend they go back and listen to that episode if they haven't already.
Yeah, that was a fun one. And you know, thank you for helping make some connections there. All right, I'm Sonny Bunch. I'm culture editor at The Bulwark, and I am very pleased to have Richard back on the show. I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Protect your boats and recreational vehicles with FBP, RV, and Marine antifreeze. It has burst-proof protection down to negative 50 degrees, keeping you protected against freezing temperatures. Keep your winter worry-free with FBP, ready-to-use RV, and Marine antifreeze now at Menards. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com and shop our great selection of automotive products.
Save big money at Menards.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.